Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Welcome, Terry. Thank you for joining us today. I'm excited to have our conversation about getting from no to yes and other neat tricks of behavior modification. But before we hop in, I would love for you to introduce yourself to our audience and give them a little bit of background on how you got to where you are now in supporting families.
Sure, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me, Wendy. I appreciate that opportunity to share some things about what I do, because I think what I do is an unusual niche. And where that comes from is I started out as a school psychologist for many years and recognized in my community that there were very few therapists who actually knew some things about behavior, you know, very good therapists in terms of providing play therapy or talk therapy, but really nobody who knows about behavior. And when it comes to therapy and kids, it sometimes doesn't mix real well because kids aren't always motivated, you know, and they may not have the skills because their brains aren't all that developed. So I decided to go into private practice and become a therapist. And I did that. But in doing that, I realized that the talk therapy bit, the play therapy bit really wasn't what I was really good at doing. What I was good at doing, which is what I was hoping to provide to the community, was providing behavioral expertise and guidance to parents. And when I realized that, that it then became very clear about how I should structure my work. And that is to primarily start with parents because they're the most motivated people. They're the ones who have the tools to help change their kids' behavior. But then my daughter said, oh, mom, you're not home anymore. Cause you know, I had to see people in the afternoons when kids were available. So like, okay, fine. I'll become a school psychologist again, which I did for another 8 years. But in that meantime, I became trained as a behavior analyst so that when I was able to go back into private practice when she was a teenager and she didn't need me or really kind of want me around anymore so much, I had this cadre of behavioral expertise that, you know, I sort of had before, but now I really had all of the tricks that behavior analysts use, but to apply in a therapeutic kind of setting, in a therapy session. So that's essentially what I do. I apply behavior analysis to therapy, and I call it behavior therapy, which is a thing, but most people don't really know what it is. So that's what we're here to talk about in part today, I hope.
Yes, yes, all of it, I hope so. So what does a behavior challenge mean in the context of parenting? I mean, I can think of it in terms of my home. I have 3 kiddos, but what does that look like in terms of parents that have gotten to a point that they're going to pick up the phone and give you a call?
Yeah. So, I mean, behavior is everything. It's everything. There's a little saying out there that behavior analysts like to use. It says behavior, it's what we do, which it is. So, but when it becomes a point that it is disrupting the home environment and the relationships within the family, that's usually when I hear from parents. But it could range from eating issues to toileting issues to sleeping issues, won't sleep in their own bed at night, can't fall asleep by themselves, to anxiety issues, you know, meltdowns because I'm afraid of going somewhere or doing something or having something change, or, you know, the more conventional physical aggression, won't listen, won't follow directions, won't do their homework, won't fall, you know, shut off screen time. Like all of those things fall under the broad, very, you know, tremendously broad category of behavioral challenges that might come through my door looking for help.
And as you kind of get to know families, have you seen a theme of what is stemming from that behavior, right? Because sometimes, in the world of special ed, we always look at behavior as a way of communicating. And so what are some things that you're seeing once you kind of get under the hood, so to say, with families?
Well, it's interesting. In terms of behavior therapy, we have a different perspective on how to address behavioral challenges or even emotional challenges, which is to really look at what is being reinforced and what behaviors might be being suppressed because they're effectively disciplined. And it's through the eyes of what keeps the behavior going and what's going to help diminish a negative behavior, not really the lens of why is this behavior happening in the first place. Now, that is important to be preventive and proactive, right? So if a kid is refusing to do their homework, right, we need to understand, is there a challenge with that academic material that's coming into play here? Or is there some executive functioning challenge or an ADHD issue that's getting in the way of our ability to complete homework? Because then we can address those things and we really need to understand that. So, but there could be lots of other reasons too. It could be just that I have never been required to do homework before. Let's say I'm in third grade. This is the first year that I've been required to do homework. And as a parent, I'm a little bit at a loss as to how to set things up so that homework becomes a regular expectation. And, I can get my kid to do my homework every day. Maybe kid is expected to, what they do is they come home and they, get on screens, and that's what they're used to doing. And now all of a sudden, they're being asked to do this task that they don't want to do. Like, that's a purely behavioral issue that we can address by putting into place maybe some motivators and maybe sequencing the schedule so that you don't get screens until after you do your homework, that sort of thing. So, there's a combination of really investigating where behavioral challenges are coming from so that we can be proactive in addressing them. And those are just so. So those are very varied and very individualized for every family. I do see a lot of ADHD. So I think your original question was, what are the things that tend to underlie these behaviors? Well, the answer is there could be all kinds of things, but ADHD and anxiety really tend to be two very common underpinnings to the behaviors that I see. So we need to make sure that we address those fundamental issues that are inherent in an ADHD presentation or anxiety, teaching kids how to manage their anxiety and what they need to do to challenge their anxiety, or with the case of ADHD, teaching kids executive function skills, helping parents understand what are reasonable expectations. And then ensuring that if kids are feeling bad about themselves in whatever way, that the parents are aware that medication can be incredibly helpful and sometimes is really necessary. That's not really my focus at all, but just to make sure that parents know what's going on and know what resources might be available to help their kid in ways other than what they can do in the home or what we can teach the kid in the home.
So, what are some key characteristics or traits that are associated in terms of behavior with ADHD and anxiety for parents?
Yeah, so they can look very similar because ADHD and anxiety tend to co-occur at a very high rate. I think there's like an 80% co-occurrence according to one study. That's just one study, but I do see them coming together a lot. But they are very distinct challenges. So with ADHD and anxiety, something that they have in common is emotional volatility. So these are kids where parents will say she goes from 0 to 60 with no warning. Now, with ADHD, it's a component of kind of impulsivity related to that. Like, I have a feeling and I react to that feeling without being able to control my response. Anxiety, if it's a kid who just has anxiety, it's a little bit different than that. They tend to, their emotional responses are due to and anxiety about particular situations. And in other ways, they might be over-controlled emotionally. So there can be some differences between the two of them. But one common similarity is big emotions that cause big problems and big disruption in the home. And parents just don't know what to do about that. you know, you want to support your kid expressing their feelings and having feelings. We don't want to tell kids they can't have their feelings, but we also can't allow them to completely disrupt the home and derail everybody and make people feel unsafe and like this isn't a home that I want to be in because it's not peaceful. Every, you know, people are yelling and having meltdowns all the time. So the emotional volatility is probably one of the biggest thing that I see. With ADHD, there's impulse control issues related to interrupting. Physical aggression is often a feature when by the time they get to me, that is often an outgrowth of the impulse control issues related to ADHD. So, you know, those are in ADHD too. Kids who have that diagnosis can be quite, might be described as oppositional defiant. And often the diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder comes up and people ask me that question. I don't really like that diagnosis because it just describes behavior. It doesn't tell us why. Kids who have anxiety can also be very oppositional. They're refusing to do things because things make them anxious. Kids who have ADHD, they sometimes just their character tends to be kind of independent and strong-willed, and they want to do what they want to do, and they only want to do things that are fun. They don't want to do things that are hard. So those are the sort of common characteristics that I see that relate, that that result in problem behaviors that then become disruptive in the home.
So if we like, if we go back and look at our title, right, in terms of getting from no to yes, and some tricks for behavioral modification. Before I actually ask the question, can you kind of talk about what behavior modification is?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I struggle with that term, behavior modification. I feel like people have negative associations with that term, and it's not the only word that we could use. There are so many other words, and I don't know that that was a great title. I'm not really good at titles anyway, but behavior modification is the same thing as behavior management, parent training, behavior-based interventions, behavior therapy, like ABA even, which is a therapy that is often thought of only as for kids who are on the spectrum, but is actually could be applied to everybody and every child. Essentially what it is using the principles of behavior theory to guide interventions to change behavior for the better. And so what that means is, you know, we only do things that we get rewarded for or reinforced for. And we don't do things that we get sort of punished for, or where, you know, if we do the thing and then something that we don't like happens, that's all punishment is. Punishment is a technical term in the field of behavior theory. There's no negative connotations. It's just like, you know, I stepped outside barefoot for the first time in the spring. Can't wait till that day. And I stepped on a rock and it hurt. So now I'm not going to go barefoot anymore. I'm going to wear my shoes. That's punishment, stepping on that rock and feeling that pain, right? So punishment is just something that reduces the frequency of a behavior. So we use those principles of reinforcement, reward, and effective, I'm going to call it effective discipline, because when it comes to sort of parenting and dealing with kids, that's what we're doing. And I don't like the word punishment because it's a dirty word, sort of like behavior modification feels like a dirty term, right? So we're using those behavior modifications, just using those principles to craft how, as parents, we're going to respond to a behavior to increase the behavior we want to see and decrease behaviors that we don't want to see. And at this, the second sort of step in that is to be thinking about, okay, then what do we need to teach our kids so that they can, so that they know what the behaviors are that we want to increase and use instead of the same old negative behaviors that they've been using. And when you put all that together, it's an extremely powerful package to change behavior.
Absolutely. And as you're saying this, I'm kind of thinking just from that, again, that special education lens and behavior intervention plans and functional behavioral assessment. And when it's done correctly, you can really see, you can kind of map out what is fueling a behavior and then coming together collaboratively to help change or modify what needs to be done for a more productive outcome in the school setting. I imagine it sounds like that's a lot of what you're doing in helping guide parents as well.
Absolutely. So as a school psychologist, I obviously worked within the school system, and I did a lot of behavior consultation with teachers. So I would set up behavior intervention plans, and we would, you know, the first step is identifying what are the factors that are rewarding or reinforcing the negative behavior so that we can try to eliminate those. What are the things that this kid finds rewarding or reinforcing so that maybe we can offer those if the child engages in the positive replacement behaviors that we may have to teach them? So that is well established, or it's becoming well established in schools. And as you probably know, like 15 years ago, that was not standard practice in schools. We've come a long way in learning how to apply ABA sort of thinking, that is behavior modification or behavior therapy or behavior theory or whatever behavior thing you want to call it, how to apply those principles in a school setting to help support kids in changing their behavior. And I do some consultation with schools still, but I take that and I'm bringing it into the home setting so we can use that expertise and that knowledge to apply to the challenges that are happening in home, which is, by the way, actually a lot easier than working with the school system because I just have a parent or two that I'm working with. And in the schools, you've got whole levels of people and an environment where they have rules and diffusion of responsibility that makes it a little bit more challenging. But one of the things that I really love to do and aspire to do is to create a system of support at home, some behavioral interventions there, and then maybe a behavior intervention plan at school that feeds, they're seamless. They feed into each other and they complement each other. So now the kid is getting consistent messages across both environments. Do you want to hear about a case study?
That was going to be my next question.
Oh, awesome. Great. So there's this kiddo that parents came to me and they're like, our preschooler is having such challenges in school. He is hitting people and we're afraid he's going to get kicked out. And so, can you help? I said, yes, I can help if the school is willing to consult with me. And they aren't always open to that. Sometimes they have their own resources that, you know, they're going to utilize. And sometimes they don't. Sometimes they are open to working with me. And so, but I said, the first thing we should do is kind of make sure that we have something set up in the home so that whatever system we develop at school can be something that you've already piloted and made sure works at home, because there were definitely issues going on at home too. So we created a little bit of a reward system at home. And of course, one of the primary behaviors that this kid gets rewarded for is being kind and being gentle, right? The opposite things of hitting and grabbing. But we have to define those things very, very specifically. They go on a list of ways you can earn points, right? So he got used to that system. He also got used to a procedure of, I'm going to say it, it's another dirty term, timeout, right? So out there in the ether, timeout has gotten a bad reputation because there are some psychologists who will say, don't do timeout, do time in, because your kid needs your attention and your love and needs your help soothing and working through a problem. Yes, your child needs attention and love and soothing. But if you provide attention and love and soothing in response to negative behavior, what are you doing? You are rewarding negative behavior. And then the mystery of why is this negative behavior keeps coming around, even though I tell my kid to do something different, well, it's because you're rewarding the negative behavior. So we need to like find a way to teach kids to calm themselves down in a way that's respectful of their ability to learn that skill, that gives them a little bit of space, does not provide them with reinforcement for negative behaviors without sacrificing our ability to soothe our child when they are legitimately upset about things. I think I'm digressing, but in any case, the timeout procedure, there is one that I have found incredibly effective as a single intervention, is the single most effective thing that I do with parents. And so this kiddo, we did the timeout at home. We did the point system at home. And then I started working with the school. And we did a little bit of a reward system at school. We had a little reset thing that we set up at school. And we set up a little sort of equivalent timeout thing at school as well. So now this child across home and school is getting a very similar reward or acknowledgments for engaging in positive behaviors that we want to see, and consistent, effective discipline in response to their negative behaviors. And that is super exciting to me, that now we've got a seamless system to support these kids in both environments. And I'm very, very hopeful that that's going to be productive for him. The third thing that we did is a whole class intervention for that preschool classroom. I don't know if you've heard of PBIS, but I'm assuming that you have, because you know about all of these things. But PBIS is kind of what we're talking about here. Positive behavior interventions and supports. It's about identify what your rules and expectations are, explicitly teach them, and then acknowledge them and celebrate them and maybe link them to some sort of rewards. So those are the basic tenets for a whole classroom intervention, PBIS wise. So his classroom is actually implementing that too. So we've got that is implemented in the home now. We've got that being implemented in the classroom now. So it's a very exciting thing to be able to do that and have all of these people who want to support this kid coming together and putting together supports that make sense to him.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just such a benefit for everybody that's involved, the kiddo, the family, and now the classroom. Can you explain what a reward system kind of looks like and what would that benefit be for a parent in their home?
Right. So the rewards that we come up with are individualized for each family. So that's really important. Some families like to make sweet treats available, for example. So maybe a kid can buy one sweet treat a day and that's like worth 2 points. Other families don't want sweet treats at all. They don't want food to be related to rewards. And so that's not on the list. Other families they want their kids to learn about money. So those kids can trade in their points for money. Other parents are like, I don't want my kids to be material about stuff, so I don't want money on the list. A prize box is a great reward for lots of kids. You know, little things that are worth just a few points, you know, like special markers or stickers or, you know, little dinosaurs or little, you know, hair things, whatever, small things that don't cost very much. But other parents are like, I don't want all that little stuff in my house. You know, no, I'm not going to put that on that list. So there are a variety of things that we can choose from. Some of the things that show up on almost every reward list would be screen time, because most parents want to regulate screen time, and they should. They should regulate screen time. Unregulated screen time is not good for kids, and we know that. And there are these recommendations that have been offered by the American Academy of Pediatrics that pretty much went out the window when COVID happened, because parents are trying to work from home while their kids are also at home and they're on screens doing school all the time. So that's been something that we really have had to shape up. But putting that on the list, screen time goes on the list as something that kids can buy as a reward. We might also talk about using sort of a little bit of free screen time as what's called a base privilege. We can talk about more of that later. I don't want to go off on a tangent with that. Other things that end up on the list of rewards would be special outings. So, you know, maybe we go out for ice cream, maybe we go out to a restaurant, maybe we drive to a special playground that's a pain in the butt to get to, but it's really special duper awesome, you know? So those would be the things that end up on the list. There are things that don't go on the list. So these things are important. Time with a parent does not go on the list. Kids should not have to buy your attention. Right? That's just not okay. Or things that you want your kid to do anyway, like playing with the neighborhood friends. Like if you want your kids to be social and playing with their neighbors, then don't put it on the list of rewards that they have to earn, or playing outside. So there are some kind of rules around that, but the most important thing is that they're individualized to what the kid is going to find rewarding, and what the parents, how they want to sort of put together the the feel of this plan for their home, because it doesn't always feel comfortable for parents to be offering points that you can trade in for prizes, for behaviors that I just want you to be doing anyway, right? So there are some very carefully crafted and importantly learned lessons about how to put together a point system.
And that's incredibly important. And as you're talking, it just reminds me. So my oldest is now 18, but we did this with all three of our children. We call them responsibility coins. And so we'd earn a coin just for, you know, the basics, being positive and sharing and, you know, all the good things that you would want your kiddos to do. And then my oldest in particular was obsessed with trains. And so once he earned, gosh, I can't remember, it was 10 or 15 coins, he could then go to the responsibility store, which at that time was Toys R Us, which no longer exists, and pick out like a little toy train. So that was very motivating for him. And we just kind of kept it for all of our kids. And so now it's like a family joke about the responsibility coins, but it worked. And then even when I taught juvenile delinquents in high school, my plan for them was that we called it the four P's: productive, prepared, positive, and punctual. And they earned points for that. And that got them into a raffle for treats at the end of the week, which that was a huge motivator. So there's all kinds of creative ways to do it. And I love how you said in terms of making a list, making it clear, what does that look like for this particular child, student, wherever you're thinking about utilizing this, but what are their particular needs, individualizing and interests so that they can have a buy-in as well. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about what buy-in is and how that comes into play when we're shaping behavior.
Yeah. So this is a very important lesson that I learned early on. I used to want to include kids in the development of the family point system because, you know, I like to be inclusive. I like to be transparent. But this is what happened when kids were involved in those sessions. So we would have to talk about negative behaviors, right? We have to talk about what's going to happen when you engage in negative behaviors. Now, when you do that with a stranger, i.e. the new therapist, kids get anxious. They don't like to talk about their bad behavior. And so they begin to act out or try to distract the conversation, to go off topic and undermine what you're trying to create here. So that was one big, huge problem. I was like, well, if we're going to have to talk about challenging behavior, we can't do it with kids in the room for a couple of reasons, because they sabotage the process, but also because then they view me as evil, like, because I'm talking about how you're going to discipline your kid. So like, well, if I just get this lady out of the picture, my parents will go back to not disciplining me. And that's actually, you know, obviously not a very productive dynamic. So buy-in is critical for parents. It's not critical for kids in terms of developmenting the point system. Parents know what their kids like, right? If they like screen time, they like trains, they like Pokemon cards, they like getting mani-pedis, they like whatever it is that they like. Parents know what their kids like. So we can put together a pretty good list of rewards without needing the kids present in that conversation. And we get it done so much more quickly without kids there. And they don't develop this negative association with me because we're, you know, talking also about negative behaviors and they don't want to have that conversation. What that allows us to do is once we get the point system up and running, which takes anywhere between 2 and 3 sessions, right? We have the initial session and then we'll have a points conversation and we might have a discipline conversation. So between 1 and 5 sessions, we'll get those things up and running. Once we do, then we know the kid is motivated. We've worked out any of the kinks and we've tweaked it because we might need to do that, right? Because it may not be working for one reason or another, or implementation may be hard for one reason or another. Once we do that, then I get to say to parents, okay, now what is the behavior that you really want to target? All right, so let's bring Joey in here and I'll meet with Joey. And the conversation will sort of go like this. So Joey, Your parents tell me like there's this new system, this new thing where you're getting like points or something for stuff. Like, tell me about that. So Joey says, "Oh yeah, I get to earn trains with my responsibility points. And the next train that I want to earn is a blah 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 train." And I'll be like, "Wow, that sounds really cool." So, did you know I work with other kids too? And one of the things that I really like to do, because I know there are other kids who have these parents who have done these systems with their kids before. What I like to do is help you figure out ways we can add stuff onto the list of ways you can earn points. So, what do you think? You know, is there anything that you can think of that your parents really, really want from you? And then I sort of lead the conversation. You know, do you think your parents would be willing to give you points if you used a calming down strategy from the Breathe Like a Bear book when you were getting upset instead of yelling at people and maybe hitting your brother? And then Joey's like, "Oh, I don't know. Would you?" Or little Emma, "I've heard your parents really would like you to be able to spend some time in your room by yourself because that's really hard for you. Do you think that if you went upstairs and you just got something from your room and then you came back down, that they would be really super duper proud of you for facing your anxiety and maybe they would give you a point for that?" And then Emma's like, "Oh, that might be hard, but I might be able to do that. And yes, I would like points. Mom, would you give me points for that?" And mom says, "Well, yeah, I would." I'm like, "Okay, we're putting it on the list." And there you go. There's our in. That's how I get buy-in with the kids to the program. So, sort of like very sneaky through
You're
the back
assuming the
door.
sale. That's what I like to call it. Assuming
There you
the
go. There you go. Rather than, you know, with most therapy approaches, parents bring their kid into the therapy session the first time and then lay out all the problems, and kids like embarrassed or ashamed and doesn't really want to talk about all that negative stuff. And then as a therapist, I, in the old days, was expected to talk to them about their bad behavior and somehow convince them to do something different. I mean, that was just a horrible conversation. It wasn't fun. Kids didn't like it. I didn't like it. And it didn't really change anything. But now I get to be the bringer of good news, and kids get excited about it, and it's fun, and they get to earn points. And then suddenly the things that we want them to do become great things that are easy and not hard conversations that are going to result in no change anyway.
back to ADHD anxiety, what would you describe as the gold standard therapy approach?
So, I mean, out there in the literature, the gold standard therapy approach for ADHD is behavior therapy. And behavior therapy does start with parents. So, you might also see that as parent training, or like we talked about, behavior management, you know, those behavior modification, those are all terms that would fall under that category of behavior therapy. And the main reason for that is that kids with ADHD, they have impulse control issues. They have a hard time paying attention to things they don't really care about. They don't really care about talking about bad behavior or poor behavior choices or what they could be doing differently. Those conversations tend to be pretty torturous for those kids, right? They don't want to sit there and talk about behavior that's been in the past. They want to go do stuff. And even if they wanted to change their behavior, they don't have the great capacity to monitor their own behavior, like see what they're doing in the moment. They don't have the impulse control to stop it. They don't have the delayed gratification to be able to say to themselves, "Oh, well, if I don't engage in this negative behavior now, and instead I do this other thing, it'll result in more positive relationships later on down the road." That's just not intact. Right. So the reason behavior therapy is the gold standard treatment out in the literature, I'm not the one who says so, the literature says so, is because so many kids with ADHD have these kinds of challenges. Difficulty thinking about your own and reflecting on your own behavior in the moment, being able to stop yourself, impulse control, stop yourself, and then choose a different behavior instead. And then there's this additional sort of layer or component of we need to motivate kids to do something different. We can't just expect that they're going to stop doing what they've always done and choose to do something different because we've told them that would be better. We got to motivate them to do that. And that's, you know, that's why this kind of an approach, behavior therapy, is so much more effective. And I'm going to say so much more effective. That's my judgment about it, because that's my experience. But I do believe that in large part, that's why behavior therapy is the gold standard treatment, because we're focusing on parents who are highly motivated, and we're using them in this process. And we're not focusing on the kid who oftentimes, with that kind of a diagnosis, but also with anxiety, is resistant to doing this work. And anxiety is a different animal. If you want me to feel like I'm talking a lot, but I guess that's the whole point.
Great. I love all those tidbits. Yes, so let's talk about anxiety for a little bit.
Okay. All right. So the issue with anxiety is not necessarily that I don't have impulse control or that I don't have delayed gratification. Those are things that tend to be more characteristic of a person with ADHD, because, by the way, as you've heard 5 million times, but people in our audience may not have heard this, person with ADHD, we can really think about them as being sort of emotionally and behaviorally about 2/3 of their chronological age. Their brain development is slower, for lack of a better term, in terms of those areas of functioning. So where impulse control comes from with maturity, you can expect your 10-year-old with ADHD to be more like 7, right? So that's why those issues are specific to ADHD. It's about brain development, about your neural, you know, your hardwiring in your brain and how slowly that's maturing. And that does, by the way, reach maturation usually, but that takes a lot longer. So be prepared if you have a kid with ADHD. Anxiety, that's not the issue, right? They have impulse control. They can be over-controlled in emotional ways, although for them, what can be challenging is holding things together, because they're anxious and they don't want other people to see them in a certain negative light. So oftentimes we'll see kids who have anxiety are perfect angels at school, and then they absolutely fall apart at home because they've been exerting so much effort to hold things together and to control it until they get home. And then where they feel comfortable, where they feel like they can let their feelings show, and then they all over the place, meltdown. Right? So that's what anxiety looks like. And the reason that behavior therapy is particularly effective for anxiety is that kids don't like to do things that are hard in general, right? Kids don't like to talk about things that make them anxious, because that's uncomfortable, right? And what we know about anxiety, just hard and fast from tons of research, is that the very best intervention for anxiety is to face your anxiety. Do the things that make you anxious. Talk about the things that make you anxious. And that is incredibly difficult. So if you bring your anxious kid to a talk therapist or a play therapist to deal with their anxiety, you might get a lot of resistance, or you might get a kid who enjoys playing with their therapist a lot. They're not really getting much in terms of reduction of anxiety. Why not? Because that therapist, if they're meeting individually with the kid, they have to make that kid have a good time with them. And it's very difficult to make a kid have a good time with you when you're also making them do things that they don't enjoy doing. So it takes a bit of skill and psychoeducation with kids to teach them that the way to get over your anxiety is to do the things that make you anxious. And we have to work in very, very baby steps. But I always start with parents there, because I don't want to turn kids off by saying, okay, what you're going to have to do is face your anxiety, right? Then they're like, forget it. Talk about buy-in. Kids with anxiety, they're tough customers. So I'll meet with parents first. We do some psychoeducation. There's always ways that parents of anxious children are accommodating and supporting their kids' anxiety, always, because parents want to be good parents. Parents want to soothe their children. They don't want to torture their children. I've never met a parent who actually wanted to torture their child, even though the kids have a different opinion about that, right? So parents want to make them feel better, but in the process of doing so, they tend to help their kid avoid or escape things that make them anxious, and that just makes the anxiety worse. So do work with parents first. That's the behavior therapy component, to talk about what reinforces anxiety and what can you as a parent do to eliminate that reinforcement, to stop accommodating the anxiety, but to still be supportive people to your child who is suffering from these really difficult feelings. The primary message to your child being, I know you can handle it. I know that it's hard. How can we make it easier, but still help you face your anxiety a little bit? Stay in the situation a little bit instead of completely avoiding it and completely escaping it. So then it sort of switches. Once we've done that work with the parent, then we might start working with the kid again. It's a lot about psychoeducation, but the behavioral approach there is, we need to help you face your anxiety. That is all behavior, right? And that'll be a lot easier to do if we have a reward system set up to reward you for facing your anxiety. It makes it a lot easier. And then my role becomes more about, how can I help make this a game and make this fun and make it rewarding instead of this horrible experience of, I have to talk about these horrible feelings that I don't really like and I don't want to go to therapy and please do I have to go, and then they drop out, right? So that's why behavior therapy, I don't know, there's a lot of research to say you need to do exposure therapy for anxiety. Absolutely, 100%. And number two, you have to involve the parents and you have to help parents figure out how to not accommodate the anxiety. And those are both very behavioral types of therapy.
We know in the world of education about early intervention, is there an age limit? How do you help guide parents that may say, you know, is my kiddo too young to come see you?
So, I mean, of critical importance is I always meet with parents first and only parents. Kids are not invited to those first few sessions. So if a, and as we've talked about in those first few sessions, I'm always A, collecting information, making sure that I understand the problem behaviors that we're dealing with here and whether there might be some related underlying diagnosis like anxiety or ADHD that we need to address in any other way. So those are specific to just having parents in the session. And then we'll move to parent-based interventions, which often, but not always, will include some psychoeducation, developing a reward system, maybe, but probably, and ensuring effective discipline, right? So once we have those foundational things, which only involve parents, then we get to the question of, should we involve the kid? Now, often when we have those things in place, whatever behavioral challenges were there, sometimes they're now taken care of. They got taken care of when we developed the point system and the discipline stuff. And now we don't really need to do anything else. But equally often, there are, you know, behaviors that continue to be problematic. So that might be toileting issues, sleeping issues, impulse control issues, emotional regulation issues, those sorts of things. Things that we might want to intervene specifically with the kid on. And then at that point, I'd be working with the parent and saying, okay, do you think it would be more helpful for me to meet with your child and to teach your child this skill or this behavior? Or do you think it would be more helpful for me to meet with you and teach you how I would do it? So one of a variety of ways that I might get at that sort of individual intervention with the kiddo. One way to do it is via a social story. So you know all about social stories. I know that you do, but I'm going to say it because our audience may not know about social stories. Social stories are an explicit way of teaching a replacement skill that we want a kid to be able to demonstrate. So if a child is pooping in their pants and we want them to poop in the toilet instead, we might write a social story about that. And it would say, my name is Jimmy. I love going to school and playing with my friends. Sometimes I have an accident in my pants. When I have an accident in my pants, my friends don't want to play with me. They say, ew, Jimmy, you smell. That makes me really sad. I want to try a different way of remembering to go poop in the potty instead of in my pants. My teacher, you know, Miss Kelly, is going to tell me at 10 o'clock to go potty in the toilet. I'm going to try hard to go poop. And if I go poop, I'm going to get a puffball. or a sticker or whatever, blah, blah, blah. So you can see where this is going. The social story sort of presents what the problem is, what the replacement behavior is, the rewards that the kid will get from engaging in that. Now, I don't need to be the one to sit down and read that social story to the child. It could be the parent. And in fact, I really like parents to take that role. I want to teach them how to use social stories if that's going to be an effective mode for their child so that they can do that for any future issue that happens. And so I'll give them like a skeleton social story. We'll develop that together and I'll share it with them online. I use Google Drive a lot to share things. And then they can take that, they can modify it, they can print it out, and then the kid can draw pictures and make it their own. And then there you go. So that's the intervention for that kid. But it might be that they would say, listen, my kid's not going to listen to me about anything. It would be better if you talk to her about her anxiety. So then I'll say, okay, we'll set up a session where I'm going to do some psychoeducation. I'm going to explain how your amygdala, which we're just going to call Amy, is the panic center of your brain. And like, this is what happens when Amy gets upset and she just sees a spider. She like freaks out. She thinks she's going to die and the spider's going to get on her. And she says, you can't go outside. There might be spiders out there. Now, how does that make you feel? Do you really want Amy to tell you that you can't ever go outside? That doesn't sound like much fun, right? And Emma's like, no, I want to go outside and play. I'm just too afraid of spiders. Okay, I can help you teach Amy not to be afraid of spiders. What do you think? Would you like to not be afraid of spiders? Yeah. Okay, so now I'm working with the kid directly. But if we're going to set up exposures, which we have to for anxiety, because that's what works, we need to give her a motivator to do those exposures because they're not fun. But we're going to make a game of it, right? Like I said before. So we might have a song about spiders so that we can at least say the word spider and we can talk about spiders, right? I might look up a cartoon video with a spider that's really fun and funny and not scary. And I might share that during a session with a child so that she can get some exposure to a spider. But it's a cartoon spider that's not very scary. It might be a little bit scary. And then by the end of the time we're watching, it's not scary at all, right? So there's a very different ways that I might work individually with kids. So in terms of age, that's not really the relevant question so much as what's going to work for your kid. I have had three-year-olds. And of course, that was like a 10-minute session that would be very short. And I'll bring a book that I have on my bookshelf back here and I'll read the book to the kiddo, right? And then we'll talk very, very briefly about how you can get these points by gentle hands, right? And then they're gone and then they go. And that was the lesson, but I said it. And so it has a lot more authority than if the parents said it, right? Does that answer your question?
It does. And how do you encourage consistency with both parents and educators in terms of you've established a system that is helping that kiddo grow? And then how do we continue that consistency?
Okay, so consistency has a few different applications, I think, in the question that you're asking. There's consistency in responses to specific behaviors. And then there's consistency in implementing a plan, right? And then there's consistency between home and school environments.
All of the consistencies
can get very complicated. And of course, consistency is important. Everybody knows that. We should all be consistent. The most important application of consistency, in my opinion, is adult responses to behaviors, specifically negative behaviors. Right? Because if you sometimes give in or sometimes give a reward for a negative behavior, then that might provoke a kid's repeated attempts to get the thing that they want by engaging in those negative behaviors. I like to share parents and teachers a little bit of research about rats at that point. So here goes. I'll tell you a little bit about rats. So we can easily teach rats to press a lever and get a treat, right? And so if we give them, in order to teach a behavior, we like to reinforce it every single time initially until the behavior is established. And then we might not reward it all of the time, or we might sort of change the nature of the reward. It might go on the list of things that we're expecting you to do now. And if you don't do them, you're going to have a consequence, right? So there's all kinds of ways we can wean kids or rats off of rewards. But if you give them a reward every single time they press the lever, they're going to press it, nibble on the treat, wander around their cage, go play with their buddy for a minute, and then go on over, get another treat, press the lever, go play in their little rat wheel, come back, get another treat, go take a nap. You get the idea. It's a very stable, you know, low rate of lever pressing. Now, if you change the rate of reinforcement to every once in a while, but we don't know when, which is, by the way, how parents often discipline. Like, we'll be consistent. We'll consistently say no, and we'll hold to it, and then we'll give you a timeout, or we'll send you to your room if you do this. But sometimes I'm just overwhelmed, and I ignore you, or I give in because it's just easier, and I can't deal with it right now. So that's inconsistent responses to a behavior. What happens when rats inconsistently get a reward, a treat, like maybe it's the first time, maybe it's the fifth time, maybe it's the 10th time that they press that lever, is all of a sudden lever pressing skyrockets. And they're like, bam, 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 I don't know when I'm going to get my next treat. I better keep on trying to get a treat because I don't know when the next one's coming, right? So when I tell that story, parents are usually like, oh, so I should never give in, is what you're saying. I'm like, yes, this is why consistency is so important, right? If you truly want to reduce the frequency of a negative behavior, you absolutely have to be consistent 100% of the time and give them that negative consequence, whatever it is, for that negative behavior every single time. And then you will truly see results. You really will, but you have to stick with it. So that's the most important kind of consistency. You know, home and school environments can be different. We don't have to have total consistency between those environments. For this preschooler that I told you about, you know, for the younger that you are, or the more, you know, if there are intellectual delays or developmental disabilities involved that are pretty significant, then having environments that are very consistent, have consistent systems set up for rewards and for consequences, that becomes much more important. But kids who have relatively typical cognitive development, I'm not saying emotional development or behavioral development, I'm saying cognitive development, they can understand that home is different from school. And that's why we often get very different behaviors in home versus school. So they don't need to be the same. It's most important thing there is that they're on the same page. You know, parents are supporting school, school is supporting parents, and kids know that this is a team and that they communicate. That is absolutely critical, because if they think that there's division between that team and, you know, they can split parents from the school, then they are going to do that, because what kids are all about is getting what they want and doing what they want. And they're supposed to do that because they're learning how the world works. Right?
Right.
They're supposed to do that, which is why I love poorly behaved children. They're my favorite. They're just trying to figure stuff out and they're being pretty successful. But what we need to do is like take a different role and ensure that we're reinforcing the behaviors we want to see, and we're effectively disciplining the behaviors that we don't want to see. So we can channel their energies, those really energetic kiddos, to doing the right thing. And that's what it's all about.
Resources and support kind of networks are available for parents and educators to just kind of help, I get educate and then empower them to continue to work together, supporting behaviors, both home and school or separately.
So schools by law have to have like a family liaison person, and it's called something different in lots of different school districts, but there's always a parent sort of connection person. And those people are really great advocates of parents who can help guide them through the resources and supports and systems and all of the very complicated things that happen at school. And the reason those things are so complicated is they're mandated by law. right? There are procedures the schools need to follow. And sometimes parents don't really understand what those things, most of the time, parents don't understand what those things are, and they need someone to help them walk them through it. So contacting the school district's appointed parent liaison or family liaison person, I think, is probably the very first place that I would go. Or maybe the second place. The first place might be the kid's teacher. You know, teachers generally are in this field because they want to help kids. They're not doing it for the money. They're not doing it because it's a cushy, easy job, because it's neither of those things. They're doing it because they love kids and they want to support kids. So, you know, just direct communication with the kid's teacher and fostering a good relationship there is so important. And assuming that the school is there to be on the same team with you and supporting your child is also important. But if you've talked to the teacher and you have the parent, you know, liaison person, then that's not been helpful. There are people who call themselves parent advocates that are out there that you can, you know, Google and get folks like that. And then there are also lawyers. If you have to go that far to get resources that your kid needs, there are lawyers who specialize in special ed law, which you know about. But I would really strongly recommend that parents recognize that the most important thing here is to be a good team that is supportive together of the child, and to remember that everybody generally has the kid's best interests at heart. And we may think that the different things are what this kid needs, but we're all here to support kids.
And then as we're kind of winding down, are there other resources or things that I didn't know enough to ask about for folks that are listening to our conversation today?
Things that we don't, I don't know. I think the one thing that I would really probably like to address, because this is always a question on parents' minds, is reward systems. You know, I don't know how I feel about that, parents will say. They'll say, you know, I sort of think that my kids should want to do these things anyway, just because they're supposed to do them. So that might be one thing. Or they might say to me, but I've heard that if I reward my kid for doing things that I want them to be doing anyway, that then I'm going to reduce their intrinsic motivation. So, you know, I'm kind of worried. I don't want to do reward systems because then they're extrinsically motivated, right? That's often a question that I will get. And what I say to that is, look, is your kid doing those things? And then they'll say, no, that's the problem. And I'll say, well, how are you going to get from here to there? Right? How are you going to build intrinsic motivation? Because I can tell you how we build it. We start extrinsically. We start by providing, you know, motivators out here via points or rewards or whatever. And then we pair that. We pair that with our approval. We pair that with behavior specific praise. Wow, that was so responsible of you remembering to put your shoes away. And I didn't even need to tell you. I really appreciate that, right? And then gradually over time, we might shift that. So if the kid then starts putting their shoes away, then we say, okay, well, now it's a must do. And if you don't do it, you're going to have a consequence. And that's how we move from extrinsic motivators to establishment of routines, at least, or intrinsic motivators to do the things that we would like them to be intrinsically motivated to do. But you're not going to get from here to there unless you have a bridge. And that bridge, in my opinion, is a reward system.
I always end my conversations with guests, if they had one tip for a billboard for parents, what would it be and why?
One tip for a billboard. I guess I would say, I'm very bad at titles, and billboards I would be equally bad at. So that's a horrible question for me, but thank you very much because it puts my thinking cap on. I would say reward the behaviors that you want to see and effectively discipline the behaviors you don't want to see.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you demystifying some of this information for us and helping it make it hopefully a little bit easier for our parents and educators that are listening. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Wendy. I appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast.
Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.